All right, it's time. Welcome to the webinar, folks. Thank you for joining us here. I find this a fascinating topic. I mean, we'll get to introductions in a second, but for folks who are not in the real estate world, it's like, well, we got all this office space. Why don't we don't have enough housing? Why don't we just turn it into housing? Seems like a great idea, right? So we'll discuss pros, cons. How hard it is to do that, what people are looking for when they're looking to do that. So we got a bunch of different perspectives here. We got developers, we have consultants, we have investors. So we'll just start with my wonderful other host. We don't go by co-host, we go by other host, Lisa Flicker in New York. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, hello.
And then we'll start, let's ladies first, we'll start with Kate. Kate, can you tell us who you are, where you work, and your experience in this world?
Sure. Hi, all. Thanks for joining today. Kate Kalignan. I'm a managing partner with HRNA Advisors. We're a nationwide consulting firm focused on economic development and real estate. And I started out my career in New York City in real estate and working for the public sector. After about 20 years of that, I relocated back out to the Bay Area where I grew up. But come to this topic, looking at office to resi conversion across the country. HRNA advised the Real Estate Board of New York as it's been having conversations with the city and the state about what it's going to take to incentivize conversions there. I've led analyses in San Francisco and Atlanta and Tulsa, and currently working with HUD as they're looking at national precedents and opportunities. And we also advise the city of Boston on creation of its policies there. So looking forward to today's conversation.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah, I look forward to hearing different perspectives. This is a New York one, but I look forward to hearing different perspectives from different cities. And then we'll go right below you with Charlie. Go ahead, Charlie.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chris, Lisa. Charlie Howe, I am with Brookfield. Been here for about 8 years in various development and investments roles. And so this kind of fits the bill on both sides of that coin. We've looked at a number of conversions recently, and are actually actioning one in our portfolio, which you'll hear about in more detail probably soon, not on this call, a little too early to mention the specifics, but in general at Brookfield, I think this really hits a kind of two themes for us, which is, we are a large office landlord. We fortunately own a lot of really great office, which is benefiting from a lot of return to office, all of the high demand for the best type of space. And then we also have a lens into the other side of the office sector, which is, class B and C non-performing assets, which you can't even give away if you try in leasing in some instances. So we really view this trend as a great opportunity to shrink the pool of available office space by removing a lot of that, non-functional and non-performing post-COVID office and repurposing it for a higher and better use. So excited to talk about it and thanks for having me.
Thanks, Charlie. Next, we have Matt Lobron. Hey, Matt.
Hey, guys. Nice to meet everybody. Thanks for having me on. I'm a part of the development team here at Silverstein Properties, obviously best known as the, owner and developer of the World Trade Center, which is not a conversion opportunity, but, we are.
Oh, it was.
Yeah. Thankfully it's not. So we are currently, I've been in development in New York for, the better part of 20 years, mostly ground up residential. We are partners with Dan's group here in Metro Loft currently on a project downtown in the financial district, 55 Broad Street, which is an office to resi conversion that's currently, underway. And we're like Charlie said, I think there's a lot of opportunity, especially in New York and some of the older, more obsolete assets. And we're hoping to participate in more going forward.
Thanks, Matt. And last but not least, and because he's so good looking, he decided not to distract You shut the camera off. We got Daniel Berman.
Guys, very nice to be here. Thank you for having me. Like you said, I'm too good looking for the camera, so I had to. No, the truth is I'm a little sick, so I'm not as put together as any of you here, or as good looking. But you know, I got involved in conversions about 18 years ago. I'm with Metroloft, which is a family business that was started by my father almost 30 years ago. And we have specialized in solely conversions, primarily in the financial district of New York City. Now we've kind of expanded to Midtown. But my role kind of, in the beginning, I started out kind of sharpening my teeth in leasing, then getting more involved on the construction end. And now I'm kind of more on the owner developer side. And we're actively engaged in, I believe, 7 projects at the moment. We see a tremendous opportunity in today's market and just generally in New York City with the current pricing of office buildings. And, you know, comparatively, we find that conversions are the easiest and quickest way to create new housing in New York City. And I guess probably anywhere else. And, you know, I think this is really the biggest remedy for the housing deficit that New York is facing.
Great group here. Alicia, would you like to kick us off with questions or want me to start?
Absolutely. So we're kind of looking at the landscape of office to residential conversions in New York. I guess the first question would be, let's talk a little bit about the market conditions for office and residential properties in New York City. I think looking at the market conditions and then looking at the things like hybrid, remote work, trends in urban and residential living, there's a lot going on there. And so would love to hear just kind of some highlights from all of you guys. Should I start with anybody?
I'll jump in just on the office side, just to underscore, you know, what we're seeing in the market in our office portfolio, which again is pretty, fortunately, pretty insulated from, you know, some of the downsides. We've announced in the last couple of weeks, I'm sure you guys have seen, you know, big lease with Citadel at the 660 Fifth Avenue project, a big lease with CBRE at the Lofts, our office product at Manhattan West, 1 and 2 and 5 Manhattan West, was substantially almost fully leased at, you know, record rents. So on the one side, the office that's good is really performing. I mentioned we are, and it is a New York City based project. We do have an existing office that, you know, best described as kind of a Class B office asset. Smaller scale users, storage, et cetera, which we are planning to reposition, and we're moving forward with that right now. And that's the other side of the story, where the non-commoditized, not luxury amenity, it's well located, but, you know, doesn't have view corridors and the newest HVAC. That product is hard and in some instances impossible to lease, even for lower rents than you may have imagined previously in one business plan. So it's a pretty stark divergence. And I think that will continue over time. The good assets will continue to perform and continue to become scarcer and scarcer for tenant demand. The bad assets will not. On the residential side, it's much stabler. The demand is, you know, pretty broad based across all product types and really almost geographic agnostic at this point. New York, obviously well reported, but historically low levels of supply and has not kept pace with population growth for decades now. And so fundamentally undersupplied market, it's going to take a long time for that to change. And so we do expect the demand to maintain at a really solid clip. Which, you know, all the more reason for non-performing assets, if you can, transition into an asset class that's in better demand, should, you know, equal a better and more sustainable go-forward return.
Dan, this question. So you said you were doing, I think you've been doing this for 18 years.
Yes.
So I've only heard really about this since COVID happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was just kind of expedited the lack of office, of people going into the office. But so apparently you were doing this before that. Like how have you seen the change and the amount of office vacancies and how remote work and how has it changed your business?
I mean, you know, I guess back in 97 or when we first began, when we told people we were doing conversions, they kind of looked at us like we had two heads. I wasn't tracking the office market so closely. We were really focused on smaller projects at the time, and trying to scale up. You know, since COVID, as Charlie mentioned, the Class A office has been doing very well, and I think it'll continue to do well. And I think in general that the office market is probably going to make a comeback, and it's showing great signs of life. But that being said, there are a lot of assets that really can no longer perform as commercial. And, you know, given the cost of leasing, the low rents, you know, the fact that you have to pay, you know, $150 TIs to tenants, give maybe a year or two of free rent on top of broker's fees, makes those buildings kind of, you know, you can only kick the can down the road for so long. And so in those cases where those landlords are seeing that, you know, you can't collect, you're not going to get your first rent until year four, makes it very difficult to keep them as office. And so we've seen pricing in office at a historic low right now. For the assets that are prime for conversion. And just as a point of reference, you know, when I started in leasing, I guess back in 2006 or I think it was then, you know, the residential prices were about half of what they are now. They've almost doubled. And citywide, we have, I believe it's about a 1.5% vacancy. And according to the latest census studies, I believe the city is under-delivering by about 80,000 units a year. So by 2030, city expects there to be a deficit of 500,000 apartments. You know, last year, I believe it was about 10,000 new units were delivered. This year will be higher. But, you know, even if we double, triple that amount, we will never be able to meet the demand. And so, you know, that just goes to show the lack of supply that's here.
And I want to pile onto that. I mean, as we've been looking at what really enables successful conversions around the country, I mean, New York City is the poster child for driving conversion first in Lower Manhattan. And then, you know, after 421G really seeded the market with even moving forward without incentives. So, you know, the combination of ongoing strong residential demand that we've seen, the history and ongoing enthusiasm by residents to live in the high-rise environment that's generally required to create demand for office conversion, and that history of successful conversion here overall points to, even beyond today, even beyond 5 years, potential for much longer-term conversion opportunities, particularly now that more of the required entitlements are already in place.
So, Matt, like, what are you looking for besides, like, when you have an office building, besides the fact that no one's showing up to it and no one wants to lease space out of it, what else are you looking for in order to say this is a good building to convert?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's obviously the physical characteristics, which I'll get into in a second, but I think, you know, one of the pieces here is that the people that, you know, ultimately in most of these situations, right, you're dealing with a distressed asset. You know, the equity has been, you know, is kind of wiped out. The bank is likely in charge, right? That's due to, probably low vacancy or high vacancy in the office, right? And the capital markets environment, which has, you know, changed dramatically in the last 5 years to where rates are up and, And, you know, the loan to values that a bank would lend on an asset have also, you know, have gone down. So you've created this situation where, you know, people that even, you know, that owned an asset and the debt's coming due, you know, they're facing an environment where they're going to have to put in, you know, good money after bad into a declining asset. And so there's people aren't interested in doing that. And that's what's really driving down the prices and creating the opportunity from the financial side of things. And that's why, you know, I think Dan mentioned that, you know, the land, you know, in this case, land building, right? But the land prices are so low that it's that you're able to do multifamily even without some of the incentives, which is really impossible to do, at least in New York, ground up, right? So, you know, that's the good news, right? And you have a whole universe of buildings out there that meet those criteria. You know, there's something like, I don't know, you know, $2 trillion of commercial loans that are going to turn over in the next 3 years. And all those loans are going to be at much higher interest rates than, you know, they were initially underwritten to. So, you know, the opportunity is going to continue to exist. And if you think about, look, any building, I don't want to say any building, almost any building can be converted, right? It's just the level of you know, there's sort of different tiers of complexity of execution that are required. And it just depends on, you know, at some point how much you know, brain damage and headache you want to go through. You know, we kind of think that in this world there's going to be sort of three classes of these buildings, and some are going to be conversion opportunities, and some are going to be, you know, quite frankly, you might be able to re-tenant and put some CapEx into, and they'll sort of float in this, you know, ongoing, you know, rental environment. And some are just going to be, you know, things you're going to tear down and you know, start from scratch. So that's kind of the high level. But if you're talking about the physical characteristics of the building, you know, I think there's all kinds of, you know, different tiers, right? And you can just go in and do a sort of a cosmetic update, right? And do the things that you need to do to put in, put residents in a commercial building. And then I'm not, you know, making light of that. It's complicated, but, you know, you can add to the top of the building, you can cut light wells into the building, you can completely change the whole, you know, heating and cooling system of the building. You can reskin the building. Each one of those things that you do, you know, adds cost and complexity to the execution, right? So there's certain buildings that have the perfect floor plate and you know, require minimal work. I think those are the low hanging fruit. They're going to get picked off pretty quickly.
And are you seeing the tax incentives being worked on? I mean, I know there was 421A that expired, then there's the new one, but I'm wondering what do you see in the horizon for the tax benefits of doing something like this?
New York City, like, really trying to move this along, like, by I guess Kate, like, yeah, is it making it easier to zone these and incentivize these? And
well,
you compared to other cities.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead, Charles.
No, please go ahead.
Oh, so, you know, regarding 421A, I forget, my brain's a little foggy, but I recall that was suspended, or I guess not extended, about a year and a half ago or a year ago. I think that's been recently extended for buildings that already have their foundation footings in place. But most recently, you know, the city passed the City of Yes, which basically has a new version of 421A called 485X, which is for new ground up construction, which offers a tax abatement for, I guess, permanent affordable housing, I think, which is great for, it's a great incentive for new construction. But the city also passed 467M, which is specifically for office to residential conversions. And that's essentially a 38-year tax abatement, which not only, you know, gives you a fantastic tax abatement, but it also kind of, it widened the eligibility for candidates of, you know, candidates for as the right conversion, meaning you can convert the entire buildings. The previous, I mean, the zoning text, or Article 1, Chapter 5, used to dictate that buildings in Midtown built prior to 1961 could be fully converted. And south of Chamber Street downtown, I believe, would have to be built prior to 1977. Now, if the buildings were not, it were built after the fact, you can partially convert it. I think if, let's say the building is a 15 FAR, I believe you could convert up to 12, if I'm not mistaken. However, you were not allowed to have any commercial tenants above residential. So in the case where you have one single tenant on the top floor of a building, would make the entire building ineligible. Now, the city actually widened those dates, I believe, by 30 years. So now it's 1991. I'm actually not sure if it applies to the downtown area, but in Midtown, at least, I know that the date is 1991. So that really widens the amount of buildings that you can convert fully as of right, which, I mean, it's a much more preferable scenario for us, at least. And so, but that being said, I think even without these incentives, the comparative, cost effectiveness of conversions makes them, makes as of right conversions appealing even without. But we welcome these, 467M and 485X, and we look to possibly take advantage of those programs.
And I give New York City credit. I mean, even since 23, the city itself had a very coherent policy and set of priorities around what kinds of entitlement changes, what kind of incentives, at least aspirationally, they'd like to see move forward. I think one of the reasons this has taken as long as it has to advance is because state approval was required. But now that's just now in place. I'm interested to see how that actually changes the pace of delivery. And as Daniel said, whether that fundamentally changes feasibility or it's just icing on the cake. And I'm curious to get everybody's take here, the entitlement changes and the modifications to what qualifies for conversion as of right, lifting the 12 FAR cap that the state enabled, some of the rezoning efforts that are underway, particularly around Midtown South, whether the entitlements is going to make it be more impactful for you and your perceptions within the marketplace. Or the financial incentives.
Hey, you stole my thunder because it's, I would say as a developer, it's somewhat rare that you can kind of give the city a lot of credit. A lot of times you find yourselves butting heads. But I do in this instance really think New York did a good job getting out ahead of a major secular trend and trying to make it easier for these conversions to happen. It's all on the margins, right? It's a balancing act. But I would say, from our experience and looking at the one asset that we are going to redevelop, the 467M really did move the needle, again, on the margin. But I have to think that there's plenty of business cases where you have an asset. If you squint, you think maybe you could lease it as an office. You believe in that business plan, or you sort of believe in that business plan. And you compare it to a residential development and they look somewhat similar. Both require some capital, both have some likelihood of success. The tax abatement is really, in some instances, what's going to push that over the edge, make some of this happen faster, and preempt a potential issue with, the tax base of the city, as well as obviously providing more housing. Dan mentioned the 485X, which is the ground up equivalent. And it's again, a good program. It has some flaws. Actually, we see that 467M is a more advantageous, abatement program than the ground up development. And so I think taking a step back to the earlier comments, what you're going to see is more of these conversions happening, which again is decreasing the office supply to the advantage of the existing performing office assets, but less ground up development because it still is pretty challenging in today's environment. And so you'll have more supply, but not a flood of supply of residential, which I think from an investor perspective achieves the right balance between the uses and winds up in a constructive environment. So all of these things are, and I do give credit to the planners. You have to balance a million different considerations as you're thinking through the right, high level adjustments. it'll take some time to really see the results and how it bears out in reality. But I do suspect that the conversion trade is going to be, you know, more and more meaningful percentage of housing production in the next few years.
What do you see as, like, when you're looking at, like, what's the, it just seems really hard with that. I'm sure it's extremely hard, but like putting in bathrooms, plumbing, just even simple things like that, windows, like it seems like it'd just be easier just to knock it down and build it again. Like what is kind of, what's the tipping point of like, all right, this is not worth doing it.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we've been lucky enough to work alongside Metroloft, right? And like Dan said, they've been doing this for a very long time. So certainly, you know, have a lot of experience and tricks up their sleeve and things like that. And you know, I think that it's you know, the sorry, I lost my train of thought a little bit.
We're all friends here. It's good.
Yeah. the different things that you can do, right, to go through the steps of the construction, you know, and add cost and time, right? And that's the real risk of development. So sorry, now I picked it up. So what's great about the conversions is that it accelerates the development timeline, right? On a normal ground up project, you have your entitlement risk, which takes time, and especially in New York City, nothing's guaranteed and it takes a long time to get your approvals. Then your construction on a ground up project is probably somewhere in 3 years from breaking ground to first TCO, depending upon the size of the building, right? And here, because you're not digging foundations, you're not putting in superstructure, you're keeping hopefully a good portion of the facade, right? There's a tremendous time savings, and the time translates into cost. And so there's a real, you know, and most of these are as of right, so there's no discretionary, hopefully not any discretionary approvals. So there's such a tremendous, you know, time savings, which translates into cost. I mean, if you depending upon the tenants and the, you know, the commercial tenants and the, you know, the stage of construction and the size of the building, you could be from, you know, start of work to getting the first person in the building in you know, 18 to 24 months or less.
That's interesting. The return on investment gets affected that way. Are there any interesting financing options that you're seeing to get these things done?
You know what, I think we see mostly traditional lending sources, although, you know, the debt capital markets are definitely supportive of these projects, and so you end up with a, you know, competitive lending environment, which is always helpful as a borrower. I was asking a colleague recently about maybe not financing, but, you know, some type of subsidy incentives for the actual physical work. I think, you know, and there are some stats out here which I will butcher if I try to quote them, but there are meaningful embedded carbon savings, obviously, from retaining the foundation and structures of these buildings rather than demolishing and rebuilding. I will be curious, and hopefully there's some enterprising, you know, ESG engineer out here on the call or listening in who also has a lens for some financial engineering and wants to figure out how to make a market. I was surprised to hear that there is not kind of a meaningful market in monetizing and purchasing some credits related to the redevelopment of these projects. I think that is probably the next step in the, you know, efficiency of this market, is figuring out how to actually quantify the level of environmental savings that these projects produce and find a way to, you know, offset emissions elsewhere. You know, obviously this is a relatively new but robust financial market, is the market for carbon savings. And I think these projects have a really good story to tell. So Lisa, the answer is not yet, at least not in a meaningful way that I think really you can tap into and rely on for underwriting. But I suspect as this continues to expand as a proportion of the housing market production, you might see some more opportunities there.
Yeah, if I could just jump in, I guess what Charlie said was very accurate. I think there are some options available, like CPACE loans, which are, I believe, for ESG-friendly or carbon-friendly projects, but I don't think they exist at the scale that we need them to in New York City. It's for smaller, I think, developments. And there's also HUD loans, but from what I hear, those are extremely inflexible. And, you know, they scrutinize every detail of your project, which will slow you up tremendously. So we have not really explored those options yet. And I guess following up on what Matt was saying, and by the way, Matt, it's been a pleasure working with Silverstein and you as well. You know, when we look at these buildings, you know, I haven't done ground up. I know Matt has done a lot of ground up. Conversions are almost infinitesimally easier because essentially you have an existing superstructure, which is more or less a topped off construction site. And not to mention most of the buildings that we see in New York City, the commercial buildings, you know, when these things were built 50, 60, 70 years ago, they weren't using computer programs to determine the exact tensile strength of the steel, of the concrete. So the engineers would say, you know what, make it twice as strong, make it three times, just make sure it's sturdy. And so we find that, you know, the slab strength of the buildings is probably three times, you know, two or three times what is required today. The buildings have tons of fenestration. They are over elevated. They have higher ceiling heights than you can kind of afford to build on a ground up. Not to mention the building's already built. So what we do in most cases is really interior build outs. You know, there's some cases where we're adding on top of buildings, which requires structural work, which it's time consuming and expensive, but it has, I don't think it, you know, it doesn't compare at all to ground up, because the process of assembling a site, you know, walking hat in hand to all the city agencies and community boards, asking for certain approvals, making concessions in many cases, it takes a lot of time. It costs a lot of money, especially with today's interest rate environment. And there's no, you know, the certainty of when the building's going to get built it's really up in the air. And it could be on a new ground up, it could be 6 to 7 years before you're topped off, or longer. And so, you know, that's how I see the comparison. And not to mention, you know, as an example, at 55 Broad Street, we closed on the building about, I would say, 14 months ago. And we've gotten our first rents, I believe, actually maybe it was 15 months ago we closed, but we've gotten our first rents in month like 13, 14. And so that really, really is, you know, beneficial to the project as compared to ground up.
Well, it sounds easy. There's a ton of side street B, C, D office in New York. I mean, I've worked in a lot of them. They're sitting there, you know, three quarters empty. Why aren't they being converted? People don't know how to do it, don't have the money, don't have the desire. Any ideas why more folks aren't doing it?
I think people generally like to view these buildings kind of as a thrift play or you know, less than a new ground up purpose built construction. But really our philosophy has always been, you know, unless the building we're going for historic tax credits, or the building has certain ornamental features that we're trying to preserve, we really strip everything to steel and concrete. We remove all of the old mechanical systems. Everything is brand new in these projects. And so when you're coming into it, once the project is completed, you will have, unless you worked in the building or you were familiar with it, you will have very little knowledge that it was commercial, and it'll feel very close to a brand new building, you know, especially after we do, you know, some light facade work or replacing spandrel panels, giving the building a nice facelift. That really, you know, that's why I think people just have the perception that it's kind of that people don't want to live in a building that was previously an office because it's not as good as a new one.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it's in the news today, right? And it's the hot topic. But I think prior to very recently, right, people, and so everyone's leaning into it, and it's in the, you know, and it's maybe even part of the marketing campaign, and tenants, residents are essentially aware of it. But in the past, I think, you know, it was not something that people sort of touted, right? So I have to agree with Dan there. So we're entering a new world where this is, you know, it's interesting and sustainable, and people are using it as part of their marketing, which is different than I think it was until very recently.
And we're also talking at a macro level, but it's the decision is going to come down to a building by building basis, and a lot is going to depend on the conditions surrounding the existing office use. What is the existing debt? What was the acquisition price? And you know, it's hard to know looking at a building from the outside what those conditions are, but as Charlie described, you know, only recently and in particular with the incentives, have you really seen the value of residential eking up over the ongoing value of office? So, you know, I think that the question is which properties are going to see that value proposition in that space, both on physical condition, but as well as the ongoing office performance.
And zoning, right? I mean, the Midtown South, Garment District, a lot of West Chelsea, a lot of these areas that are currently targets for rezoning, you know, wisely, I think, by the current administration and city planning, you can't build residential today. And that means you can't convert an office to residential today. So people walking around wondering why this building is office instead of residential. Oftentimes, that factors in, if not, you know, plays the definitive role. So if you can't do it as of right, it's, you know, it's challenging to go through processes here. And you see in, you know, financial district where Dan, obviously Metro Lofts have a lot of success. It's been as of right for a longer time. And there's been a lot of great examples and you know, overwhelming success of repositioning a lot of assets down here. So I think like I said, you're going to see now in a supportive environment, a lot more of these start to happen.
You know what? Let's talk a little bit about some of those conversions that happened. I feel like getting into kind of the meat and potatoes of some conversions that you guys have worked on would be really exciting for people to hear. And Kate, for you specifically, I also would love to talk about the difference between doing it in New York City versus elsewhere, because I have to imagine there's a big difference.
The entire market conversation we're having right now is completely specific to New York City. Again, based on the physical context, based on the strength of the residential market, based on the history of conversions, you know, and even the city and its partners getting out there as quickly as they did to enact entitlement change incentives is relatively unique. There, you know, there were some other communities that moved faster, Boston, D.C., just based on their ability to move independently. But, you know, again, a lot of it comes down to the strength of the residential market. But I would love to hear from Charlie, Matt, Daniel about some of your specific projects that you've worked on.
Yeah, let's do a case study, quick case study. Who wants to go? Dan, you want to talk about the one that you just mentioned about they just got rents in?
Yeah, absolutely. So 55 Broad Street, which, as I mentioned, I worked on it with Silverstein and with Matt. It's about a 450,000 square foot building that I believe it was built for Goldman, specifically by the Rudin family. Beautiful curtain wall building, which we are converting into 571 units. And, you know, what's really significant about this project, for me at least, is that this is probably the most, ESG friendly project that we've ever worked on, meaning that we recaptured all of the mechanical areas in this building to turn into resi. And our You know, Metro Loft, we're working on a new patent for a mechanical system, basically, which allows all of the fresh air for each unit to go out through the window. So intake and exhaust through an air source heat pump. And additionally, we have, the building is fully electric, in part because of local law 97, which I think dictates that you have to be electric. But, every unit is essentially modular, meaning that it has its own hot water heaters, its own, intake and exhaust. And so from that perspective, we were able to eliminate a tremendous amount of inefficiency that is typically seen in buildings, having tremendous cooling towers and boilers and condenser water loops that essentially used to circulate 24/7 throughout a building, which caused, obviously a lot of energy loss. And so, on top of being efficient as a conversion alone, this new kind of modular system, kicked this thing into the next level. I don't know if we can measure exactly how efficient it is compared to the previous iterations, but, functionally, operationally, we don't need to have, you don't need to have a nuclear scientist running all the systems, essentially. It's, if there are issues in a unit, you can replace the heat pump in 15 minutes. And everything is really controlled within the units. So, theoretically, you could get a TCO on a per unit basis, which gets you your rents a lot faster and just accelerates the process. Also, our construction teams came up with a very clever way to, rig the staging of the building. So we actually had an interior hoist running up the building, so nothing had to be done at the street level. All of our windows were replaced from within the building. And it was really, I think, one of the smoothest jobs we've done. It's still in progress. It'll be done in a couple of months. But it was really like a plug and play in terms of getting this thing up and running. And, not to mention Rudin, they keep their buildings in fantastic shape. So we were able to maintain a lot of the existing lobby, elevators, and just give it a nice facelift with decorating and kind of softening features, lighting, throwing in a ton of amenities, awesome co-working space, a catering kitchen, a gaming lounge with a sports simulator, about a 5,000 square foot gym with all of the bells and whistles that you would want. And so this has been a really, really, and a pool on the roof, which is somewhat unique for a rental building. And so this is really, sorry?
Sign me up.
You got it. Well, I'm giving you a pool pass right now. But really it's been I think the building has been a tremendous success. And got to give credit to Silverstein and Metro Loft, our construction teams. They really, I think, hit it out of the park on this.
Yeah, I mean, Dan said it all there. I think, it is incredibly ESG friendly. I think it's it will be, we expect it to be LEED certified. So I think it'll be the first LEED certified conversion in New York. I can't state that for fact, but fingers crossed, hopeful that that checks out. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I think we did benefit from, all the things Dan said. The lobby was in fantastic shape. So that really, we didn't really change very much in the lobby, which saves a tremendous amount of time and cost. And, the Rudins had done a nice job of the building was a little less than half occupied when we took possession. That's, I think, one of the things we haven't talked about here. The construction execution is always tricky, but that's just sort of basic blocking and tackling. But you have to also, pay a tremendous, in the due diligence process, right, pay a tremendous amount of time and a consideration and attention to the commercial leases and to make sure that there's nothing in any of those leases that can trip you up down the road, that you're comfortable with the market conditions to buy out or relocate tenants within or outside your portfolio, as the case may be. You know, and that you can get enough space. And if you're not able to relocate everybody. So I think all the things, you know, Dan said, sort of, and it worked in our favor in this case, that, you know, and I think, you know, you're talking about these Class B and C buildings, and there's, you know, the office, the sort of softness in some of the office market has really benefited the conversion thesis, right? Because if you had a tight vacancy and rising rents, well, people would have trouble relocating. But in this case, you know, there's plenty of space available directly and through sublease, and landlords are willing to, you know, pay TIs, cover TIs to get people in. So it's, you know, that's a real benefit to this process as well.
Yeah. I'll just throw in, as Matt mentioned, you know, the building was significantly occupied when we purchased it. It was about 50% occupied, and not a single tenant remained. We, you know, this was mostly due, I think, to our smooth negotiations. But in all seriousness, you know, the tailwinds couldn't be better right now for commercial tenants. You know, there's hundreds of landlords waiting with open arms to give them new leases, and very sweetheart deals. And so I think that helped it as well. But yeah, I think it's definitely cool to see this project getting completed.
Not to mention your good looks. I'm sure that helps. So what's the, what do you see for office to resi conversions over the next 5 years? Is it going to just continue? Like, I mean, now that Brookfield's getting into it, like you're going to find like the Tishmans and the RXRs and the big, you know, the big landlords start jumping more into this, or like a lot of the, you know, I imagine it might be easier for the big ones. The smaller ones might be more bigger hurdle for them to do this. Like, what do you picture happening over the next couple of years?
You know, I think over the next couple of years, and it's already happening, there's a lot of very smart developers who've wrapped their heads around this. It's not as complex as it may seem. I guess some projects are more difficult and more, you know, with deeper floor plates that are more challenging, that require structural work and courtyards, such as a project we're working on with GFP. It's 25 Water Street. That's basically an acre floor plate. So we had to cut two courtyards into it to create the efficiency and light and air that we needed. But, you know, I think there's, and by the way, they've been doing a fantastic job on that building. I think there's a lot of developers that are realizing that now is, you know, you got to strike while the iron's hot. The pricing right now is, it's a dream. And a lot of these assets, you are buying basically, you know, superstructure at less than the cost of the land it's sitting on, which doesn't really make any sense. But I think people are starting to understand it. And I think this is going to be one of the more feasible ways to create new housing in the city. I just think there's not a lot of sites left to build, and, you know, it's extremely expensive. There's a lot of execution risks, and it's going to have, you know, something's got to give. I think this is the future in creating new resi housing.
So we're going to get to the Q&A. There's a couple questions here. This is from anonymous attendee. Doesn't want to be recognized. What's a very broad question? What's the best way to find these projects suitable for conversion? Just find them marketed, or are you kind of, how are you finding these projects?
I'll take that question. You know, generally we are being approached, you know, we don't go out looking for projects, although we do have, you know, my father has in his office an old, I think it's called the Commercial Office Directory, which is a big book. It's almost a foot thick, but it has a basically comprehensive index of all of the as of right, or I guess, I think it's from 1980. I forget which year it is, but it basically shows all of the buildings in New York City. And, you know, we've looked at that book for many years, and he's had a big wish list. And, you know, a lot of these things kind of fall into our lap, so to speak. We get phone calls from brokers, from owners, from other developers who are seeing the buildings come up. I think, you know, the best way is really to speak to the brokers. And, you know, that's at least as far as I know.
Anyone else want to answer that too?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like all origination. You know, you gotta be out in the market, talk to brokers, talk to other owners, and you know, you're buying an office building here, right? So sometimes you're buying with the intent to convert, but not always. And I think it's important to analyze the conversion opportunity relative to any opportunity to re-tenant it or to convert to a different use. And we see some of that in locations either where residential is not possible or buildings where physically it doesn't suit well for conversion. So I think it's just another, to Dan's point, well-known, not becoming more known, which is more easily underwritable and a, you know, tool of the trade for potential investment.
Thanks. Lisa, you want to ask the next one?
So we have a question from Ken Punceranelli. Hopefully I pronounced that.
Punceranelli.
Hopefully it's close to correct. Seems like existing debt on a building and cost of construction for improvements at soft cost can make a conversion a non-starter, unless there is a secret sauce, question mark. Anybody have any thoughts on a secret sauce?
I think fundamentally on cost, and Matt addressed this earlier, I think, but you know, when we look at this, any building physically can be converted. Just depends on how invasive that needs to be. And obviously, at some point, the invasiveness outweighs the benefit of converting, and you don't have a feasible project economically. And we typically, as a very, very rough rule of thumb, we typically find that that point is when you need to go in and like substantially rehabilitate the existing structure, or even, you know, fully reinforce the building. The big savings from these conversions is on not needing to rebuild the foundation, the structure, and a lot of the facade, which Matt already covered. Once you lose that, you start to talk about pricing, but construction pricing that is in the zip code of what it would cost to build a ground up. And then, you know, you lose the benefit of these conversions. And if you build a ground up building, you're going to end up with more efficient apartments, you know, purpose built, should outperform on a rental basis compared to conversions, you know, all other things being equal. And so you really do need to have those cost savings to justify these types of projects. So that's like the high level, but otherwise, you know, the costs are similar. You're hiring the same designers, architects, engineers, similar consultants, and, you know, you should realize somewhere in the magnitude of, you know, 10 to 30% physical savings, and not to mention the time savings of being able to do it quicker. Those are obviously rough rules of thumb, but that's what we sort of rely upon in initial screening.
Yeah, Ken says he brings this up. The reason he brings up the debt and CapEx improvements, because they've looked at a few projects in Denver, and they never got past the spreadsheet stage. He says he loves the work you guys are doing. Seems like it works better in higher rent markets.
Yeah.
Which kind of gets us to the next question, which is these conversions seem to focus on high-end luxury rent, you know, luxury apartments. Do you think there will be a market for conversion to more affordable housing?
Yeah, I think that's the four. Sorry, I jumped in and Kate was going to speak, but I think that the 467M is going to, you know, it's an incentive to take some of this market rate housing and provide an incentive for developers to make a portion of it affordable housing, right? And you know, I think certainly it's something we're looking at 55 Broad. And I would imagine any of the new projects are looking at it, because at least in New York, you know, it seems to be pretty accretive to have a 35-year you know, tax abatement, even though the apartments are permanently affordable. You know, I think, you know, and I would imagine that in other in other jurisdictions as well. You know, it's an alternative that's available that will provide some affordable housing.
Great. And Brian Jones asked, in addition to reuse of the existing building structure, are you typically using other sustainable building materials, energy efficient systems, et cetera?
You know, I touched upon it slightly earlier. We are using air source heat pumps now for heating and cooling the units, as well as individual hot water heaters in all the units. So by modular, by making everything more modular, it's really increasing the efficiency of the building overall. Not to mention, you know, we use very efficient, well-insulated windows. For example, I live in one of our buildings. I never have to run the heat in the winter, almost never. And you know, that's as far as sustainability, by eliminating all of the traditional cooling towers and those types of, you know, boilers and condenser water loops, that makes the project a lot more easy to execute. It increases the amount of floor area that we're able to convert into apartments, and it's overall just way more ESG friendly than any comparable systems.
Gotcha. So our last Q&A from Tom Roski: with the upcoming conversion of 5 Times Square, do you see the Times Square area seeing more large scale conversions? I can't imagine living in the middle of Times Square, but
I would say, I would just jump in and say, absolutely. I think citywide, there are a tremendous amount of opportunities for conversion. 5 Times Square is a project we're actually involved in, which is going to be fantastic. And, you know, I think regardless where you look in the city, there's tremendous opportunity. So yes, this means.
Gotcha. Well, I appreciate that. Actually, I used to live on 48th and 8th, so I have lived in Times Square. So that's the last question here. And also, Kate, I want to ask you one question. You seem to cover a lot of markets here, and we're in the Bay Area. Like, how does this, we can have all, we're gonna, I mean, I think we might do a whole webinar in the Bay Area, in San Francisco, but like, how does this compare to the one that we hear that's the biggest downtown vacancies, the Bay Area? How does this conversation compare to that one?
I keep touching on the value of residential and the strength of the residential market in Manhattan. And downtown San Francisco had not historically had as much multifamily housing baked into the midst of the office district, and not as long of a history of conversion. And the residential market hasn't returned to where it was pre-pandemic. So that has been a key struggle on top of the condition of the capital markets. They have been moving toward, you know, streamlining incentives, eliminating transfer taxes. There's now new state legislation pending that would provide the equivalent of an abatement. So they're looking at the same kind of tools that New York is looking at, but they've got a bigger gap to close. So you're starting to see projects being discussed. There's potentially one that might actually be moving forward in the near future, but there's some catch up happening there.
I didn't even think about like how New York is so unique with that. Office towers near residential, and there's supermarkets like in the, like downtown San Francisco, where are you going to buy food? Where are you going to go to the laundromat?
Well, and the other, one of the other key differences is we were just talking about the role of conversion in driving affordability. In downtown San Francisco there and across San Francisco, they're starting with mandatory inclusionary. And so with conversions not working at market, the question becomes, can you actually whittle back some of that affordability requirement in order to make things work? So finding that right level of affordability requirements versus incentives without disrupting something that we want to see happen in the market is this ongoing conversation between the public and private sectors.
And that is what's called a teaser. Stay tuned for the next webinar. Kate, Matt, Charlie, Daniel, and Lisa Flicker, and Zoe Fonzo behind the scenes, thank you all for the webinar. Thank you all for who attended. And yeah, stay tuned for more office to resi conversions.
And thank you, Chris.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for all
having me, guys.
Thank you. Feel better, Daniel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. Be grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com.